Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Tuesday, November 18th. This morning, we get the latest from Hawaii's blood bank. Our blood supply is being challenged by the demand, and there is a need for all types. We learn what unsealed court records reveal about a federal probe into a Hawaii defense contractor. We also talk about artificial intelligence. There are tools out there transcribing local government meetings, but sometimes the tools don't always get things right. We hear two takes about the promise and the peril. And communicating with care. What can we do better in the workplace? Striking a balance with candor and respect. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. This year has already seen more traffic deaths on Hawaii roads than last year. And in the last month, the number of crashes on the highway that have led to fatalities and casualties have taxed not only our first responders, but those in our hospitals. It's also created a strain on our blood supply. On the Big Island, there was a head-on crash in October that killed a grandmother and her three-week-old grandchild and seriously injured several others. Here on Oahu, three children sustained injuries from a crash on Friday, and there have been numerous cases involving pedestrians. And here's a fact that may be startling. We only have a week's worth of blood on hand, and there have been days when the supply has been quite thin. This morning, we talked to Kim Onwin, the CEO of the Blood Bank of Hawaii.
It has been extremely busy. I'm actually doing this call from our main donor center at Yonge Street, and walking in today, I talked to one of our lead staff members, and I said, "How are things going?" And she looked a little bit. And she said, 2 days in a row the weekend, we were just a little bit below need. And it just hit home to me how our staff, they're not just there to draw blood. They feel the ownership of Hawaii's blood supply. And every day that they make gold, they celebrate because they know what it means. And every day that they're just a little bit shy, they feel that ownership. Every morning, we have a meeting, and it's attended not just by our staff, but by our hospital blood banks, and we share what's on our shelf. We also have the hospital share what's going on in their world. And so during this time, they've been telling us about the massive transfusions, the trauma calls, the open heart surgeries, patients with cancer, leukemia. So we try to keep our finger on the pulse, and it's been rough.
You mentioned that there are surgeries that are ongoing in those hospitals, but the unexpected trauma cases that are coming through the ERs, and we are seeing multiple victims, and your heart just goes out to those first responders and for the folks in the ERs, because you know that the demand is there and you worry, do they have enough supply on hand?
I'll say that most people don't know how fragile and perishable Hawaii's blood supply is. And when times are good, Hawaii only has 1 week's supply of blood on hand, believe it or not. 3.5 days at the hospital, sitting on the shelf, ready to go, and 3.5 days here at the Blood Bank of Hawaii. When that trauma, that accident, that shark bite comes in to the ER, and a trauma is called, the doctors have to work so fast, they don't know the patient's blood type. So they have to default to using universal blood, which for red cells is O neg. Because of how busy it's been, we now have just 1 day, not a week, but 1 day supply of O neg on our shelf. This morning with platelets, that they help stop bleeding, and then the red cells help replace what's lost. We started out, usually we have about 5 days of platelets on hand. We actually are down to just 11 doses now, where we are comfortable at maybe 40. So our platelet inventory is down to half of where we need it to be, and that is because patients have used 25% more platelets this month alone than are normal. our shelves are feeling a little bit bare, and we have a need.
You mentioned the shark bite case, and I know there was also that freak accident, a hiker who was impaled by a branch on a windy day hiking up Mauka, and there's the danger of just bleeding out.
That's absolutely correct. The statistics are that patients who have traumas, who, if they were to get into the hospital, they could actually be treated. But in the early phases, if they bleed out, they won't make it. And so it's the blood that's there on the shelf that goes in fast. That early blood is critical for saving their lives. So most people don't realize. So how much can you bleed out? So a normal, healthy adult might have about 10 doses of blood in their whole body. And if they are impaled or the shark bites their leg and severs an artery, they can lose half of that entire blood supply so quickly. And at that point, the risk of death becomes closer to maybe 50% or higher. It can be a coin toss whether they survive. So having blood on the shelf, universal blood, but all blood types, is truly what keeps someone alive in these situations.
I was reading the account of that surfer that was injured in that attack, and he was a lifeguard off duty. He knew, you know, what to do, but he said he was just so weak he couldn't tie a tourniquet. And the folks that went out to help him were able to do that for him. But you don't realize how weak you can become when you start losing blood like that.
That's right. And on the opposite, I've seen patients that look like they were at death's door, little boys. And when the blood went in, after that transfusion was done, I saw this little boy wake up and ask his mom for a hamburger. He said, "I'm really hungry." And the mom, who was a little bit skittish about getting blood and diseases and all that, she became a believer that minute. My son came back to me.
Yeah, and you don't know how precious that gift of life is when you can give a transfusion of blood. I know that in recent weeks we've had some major pileups on the highways and multiple patients sent to the ER, many children.
A little child has a lot less blood, and so they can lose their blood supply very quickly. And I will just say that we are very cognizant of the need for pediatric care. And so we actually have some specialty blood that's set aside for everybody, but mostly for our children, not just here on Oahu, but also on the neighbor island. So there's specialty blood for children. So we call it kids' blood for babies, and cytomegalovirus antibody negative, O negative. We even have specialty bags. Little bags for little tiny babies in the neonatal intensive care unit full of plasma. And we do this because children are special. And we are the stewards of Hawaii's blood supply. But Hawaii's blood supply, it doesn't come from us. It actually comes from everybody out there walking around. So that's what I like to say all the time, which is you are Hawaii's blood supply, not Blood Bank of Hawaii.
What can you tell us about maybe expanding your reach as far as getting out to the neighbor islands or just the expansion plans here on Oahu?
Absolutely. So with the increasing need, and over the last 6 years, we've seen that the need for platelets continues to grow. And so we need to grow as well. So we've grown in two ways. One is we go to the neighbor islands every month. We send a team there, send all of the supply, and I just want to say a word of gratitude and thanks to all of the donors in our neighbor island communities. We've asked, and they've said yes. So our neighbor island blood drives are busier than ever, and thanks to every single person on that neighbor island in that community. But a second way that we're growing, I'm so excited to announce that Blood Bank of Hawaii is finally completing its new headquarters, and we will be moving to Kapolei. And so we're getting the keys to the new building in just a couple weeks, and then we'll be moving over the holidays, and by February, March, we'll be in Kapolei. So you talk about expanding reach, and that is going to take us far to expand our reach.
I know that you folks have had to deal with rail construction, but gosh, I guess the community can come out and celebrate when you open the doors out there on the
Absolutely.
West Side.
Absolutely. We can't wait. We're going to have our grand opening in March, and what an amazing year, because 2026 is Blood Bank of Hawaii's 85th anniversary. So we'll have a lot to celebrate this year.
That was Kim on Nguyen of the Blood Bank of Hawaii. Look for links on our website later today to find out how you can be a donor.
Support for HPR comes from Blue Note Hawaii. Pianist Elijah Fox performs a blend of jazz, impressionism, and soul in tunes such as Wyoming, 7 p.m. this Thursday. Tickets at BlueNoteHawaii.com.
Hey, Yo-Yo, remember when we went to that remote island in Hawaii?
Absolutely. Molokai. It is so different from all the other islands in Hawaii.
I'm Ana Gonzalez. I've been traveling with Yo-Yo Ma for the last few years.
I'm so grateful to be here.
And in Hawaii, we saw how a place can contain so many memories buried in the land.
Growing up, it was always like, oh, that's where they sent all the sick people.
Listen to Our Common Nature from WNYC wherever you get podcasts.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Energy, assisting local businesses in reducing energy waste. Learn more about lighting upgrades available through February at hawaiienergy.com/lighting.
The Justice Department is working to recover money from a Hawaii company that was under investigation for misusing federal funds. Honolulu Civil Beat reporter Nick Ruby joins us this morning. And Nick, this is a story that you've been tracking for some time.
That's right. This is a case that started really back in 2023 when federal agents raided the headquarters of the Hawaii Native Corporation, which is a nonprofit that was founded by Christopher Dawson, a Hawaii businessman who basically had made his fortune off of federal contracts that were given preferences that were given to Native Hawaiians, and particularly Native Hawaiian organizations such as his. And now these contracts were no-bid contracts, and in exchange for that work, he was supposed to be using his profits to be giving back to the community. This new case is an asset forfeiture case that sort of arose out of that federal investigation that started back then in 2023.
Yeah, and Chris Dawson, I know, was with the Dawson Group, right? He had a number of different companies, and they still do work with the military.
That's right. So I think we need to be careful about which companies we're talking about, because there's the Hawaiian Native Corporation, which is sort of the umbrella organization that owns several companies that do business with the federal investigation. The Dawson Group is a separate company that Christopher Dawson had set up, according to the DOJ, and he was using it as a shell company to siphon millions of dollars out of his federal contracting firms and the Hawaiian Native Corporation. Now, I think the key thing here that the DOJ alleges is that the money that Dawson and others were allegedly taking from these companies and the nonprofit was money that should have been used to help uplift the Native Hawaiian community, such as by investing in various cultural programs and other things that essentially help the Native Hawaiian people in Hawaii.
Yeah, and we should probably mention that, you know, Hawaii Public Radio is a beneficiary of some of those funds. We were underwritten, I think, by the Dawson Group.
Yes, the Hawaiian Native Corporation does underwrite the Hawaiian Word of the Day, which I'm sure many of your listeners have heard. But that is one of the things that they counted as their give back to the Native Hawaiian community. But of course, this case centers on allegations that much, much more money was siphoned out of the company than was actually used to help Hawaiians. Specifically, the DOJ says that one of his shell companies received $17 million through this embezzlement scheme, as they described it, whereas the Hawaiian Native Corporation, the charitable arm of the Dawson companies, received about half that amount.
And we should mention that Chris Dawson died by suicide last December, and you know these documents then are just being unsealed, so we're learning more about the probe.
Yeah, so what we're finding out is a little bit more about the Justice Department's criminal investigation into Dawson, as well as other executives who are alleged to have participated in the wrongdoing. But this case is a civil forfeiture case. So this is just an attempt by the DOJ to recoup some of the money that Dawson and others are alleged to have stolen, potentially with the effect of maybe eventually getting some of those funds to, back to the Native Hawaiian community.
And so what properties are they looking at?
So there are four separate properties that the DOJ is looking at, and combined they have a value of a little bit over $8 million, and those include a $3.5 million beachfront home on the North Shore and a six-bedroom estate in Florida that's close to the polo grounds there, the U.S. polo grounds. And now, of course, polo was a big part of Christopher Dawson's life. He spent millions of dollars on it, and the DOJ said some of that money was stolen.
All right. Well, I guess we'll just have to track and see, how successful this is and how this all plays out in the end.
Yep.
Yeah, but all very interesting. We now know more based on the unsealing of these records. But thank you so much, Nick.
Thank you, Catherine. I appreciate your time.
That was Nick Ruby of Honolulu Civil Beat. You can read his story online at civilbeat.org.
For hospitals looking to hire nurses and other workers from overseas, the H-1B visa fee has gone from $200 to $100,000.
They just simply cannot afford it. It's not sustainable. So at the moment, H-1B for healthcare workers is at a standstill.
I'm Kai Rizdal. That makes things complicated, especially for rural hospitals. More next time on Marketplace.
Beginning this evening at 6, following All Things Considered.
Support for HPR comes from HMSA, celebrating over 87 years of dedication in supporting the health and well-being of the people of Hawaii with a commitment to caring for the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
Using artificial intelligence tools to listen in on public meetings is a growing trend across the country. Journalists in Maine and Michigan have used AI to summarize school board meetings and to find story leads. A local think tank is now trying out a tool in Hawaii that they hope will increase transparency. Joe Kent is the executive vice president of the Grassroot Institute. He created the Open Hearings tool after he felt he was wasting time and money to hire interns to monitor meetings. The tool tracks 26 government bodies in Hawaii, from county councils to neighborhood boards. Kent spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender about the new AI tool.
I remember sitting in a long government hearing on Maui, and they passed a tax hike. It was like at midnight. And I was like, there's got to be a better way to do this. So we hired some programmers and made this tool that plugs in and listens to government hearings and automatically transcribes them and summarizes them so we can know what happened quickly. And it emails us too every morning. It says, here's what happened yesterday in the government hearings. Now, of course, I know it was written by AI, so I can click on the hearing and check it to see what was real. And it also allows me to chat with it as well. I can ask, at what time code did the major vote occur? Or was there anything embarrassing that happened in this hearing? Or what did testifiers think of the proposal? It's just been a really neat and unique way for me to know what's going on. And I thought, well, gee, maybe this would be useful for other people.
Was this something that was trained on Hawaii-specific data? Or are we taking kind of your run-of-the-mill large language model and saying, here, let's look at Hawaii's meetings specifically?
It's not trained or tailored to Hawaii. It's just the base, whatever model there is. I mean, transcription models just transcribe. And so, you know, if somebody says a word, there's no regional training required, except for maybe an accent. Now, in Hawaii, though, we know that even like human beings get Hawaiian words wrong all the time. And so I'm able to list Hawaiian words or any words to make sure that it gets, for example, lawmakers' names correct or Hawaiian phrases that are said often correct, like aloha, for example. So I am able to steer it a little bit, but pretty much we keep hands off and let it be neutral.
I will say that I was looking at a recent neighborhood board meeting and the AI-generated summary that your tool produced, and it spelled Koki Frog, K-O-K-I, which I thought was funny.
Yeah.
But that, I mean, that's one example kind of on the less problematic end. But it also spelled one of the speaker's names wrong. And so then you start to maybe get into the territory where you need to think critically about the issues that these AI-generated summaries have. I wonder what your position is on that.
So I think that there always should be a human being involved somewhere in the process. So like right now, I'm just using it for myself, and I know that these are flawed AI tools. And if I want to understand, you know, what happened in the government hearing, I can click on the time code at which it occurred and see for myself. But the AI summary kind of gets you most of the way there. In the same way that a YouTube transcription is often garbled or wrong, or they make a mistake, or someone hiccups, or two people talk at the same time or something. And so there's kind of understanding, at least with transcriptions, people are kind of giving it a pass. Now, I don't want to make this the news or anything, but I think in the future, 10 years from now, these types of technologies are going to improve vastly. And people might be getting more of their news from computer sources. So,
what do you think people in Hawaii could glean from a tool like this? And why do you feel like transparency when it comes to government meetings, neighborhood board meetings, that's the perfect place for quote unquote AI disruption?
Well, if you look at the counties, for example, there's a lot of government hearings that are not covered. A lot of people have no idea what's going on in the government. And the problem with that is that allows lawmakers to operate in relative obscurity on many things. My hope is that there can be more transparency about what's going on in the government and more people basically watching. And that will create a pressure on lawmakers to act more responsibly. You know, there's an old saying that sunshine is the best disinfectant. And so the more people we have watching the government, the better.
I could see a critic of this approach saying, why spend the money to hire a programmer to assimilate all these AI tools to summarize meetings when you could hire more journalists to do that? So what would your response be?
Well, my response is there are journalists right now who are using the tool in Hawaii. we've given it just to random journalists, just for fun or for beta testing, I guess. And they're finding it very useful in the same way that somebody might go to YouTube and check out the transcription there. It just helps them get to the heart of the meeting a lot quicker. Now, those articles are not being written by AI. They're being written by the journalist, who has to still do a lot of work to compile all of the research and interview people after the fact. But at least if they can get a quicker handle on the meeting, then they can be quicker at writing the story.
Can you share who those journalists are?
No, that's private information right now. I wouldn't want to disclose that. But we would like to make it available for all journalists, of course, who, if anyone wants to use it, they can sign up at openhearings.com.
This tool exists as a website that anyone can go to. And what was your philosophy there of like putting something kind of in the beta test phase out into the world, and whether you see the benefit outweighing any potential costs when it comes to AI hallucination or misinformation or what have you?
Well, we basically wanted to try it out as an experiment to see what happens. If nobody wants to use it, if there are problems, then we're happy to just pull back and close the door. So it's a door we can walk through and walk back out of and shut down if we need to. But basically, we'd like to get data on whether this is interesting or it's going to lead somewhere and whether it actually does produce some good. Now, I know that there are some hesitation with AI, but there's already a lot of people using AI every day with Google, for example. If you Google anything, there's an AI-generated summary that pops up. Oftentimes, if you look at videos and things like that, there's an AI-generated summary. There's already a lot of Zoom apps that summarize meetings. And this is just doing the same thing for the government.
Do you have any examples of a time that it's been useful for you in your own research?
Yeah. So for us, I have it programmed to send me an email every morning. And that email tells me a little summary of what happened, headlines, basically. And so then I can click on the headline and see. And one time I clicked on a headline that talked about a food truck ban that they were doing on the island of Maui. And so we were able to dig into that more and address that from a policy standpoint. My think tank, the Grassroot Institute, helped to reduce those regulations to allow food trucks to operate. And so for us, that was a win because otherwise it would be more difficult to find that information. Now, the news did cover that, but it's a few days late, might be 3 or 4 days late. But this is basically right when it happens. So we're able to just respond quicker. And time is really important in the policy world. So,
any advice you might give users of this or reminders, whether it's keep your thinking cap on, know the ins and outs of these models before you rely on them to tell you what you need to know?
Yes, well, every part of the transcript has a time code, and it encourages you to click to see where in the video someone said something. So always double check with AI. Even ChatGPT or Claude or Gemini, they have disclaimers all over their models that say, check for important information because, of course, you never know what's going to spit out. The same is true, by the way, with any journalist. Anything you read in the news, you should check as well. Don't just blindly follow either people or robots.
Civil Beat also has some AI tools that they're introducing to try to boost transparency as the legislative session begins. But in your mind, what do you hope the effect would be on lawmakers or on the general public and how they interact with our representatives?
Well, yes, Civil Beat is also releasing an AI tool that does some transcription of the government. And that's great, as far as I can say. The more of us, the better, because at the end of the day, like I said, the more people watching what the government is doing, the more pressure that we put on lawmakers as a public to hold them accountable. And I think that we're in the phase, the dinosaur phase. One day we're going to look back at this and laugh at how rudimentary this all is. And in the future, this is going to get a lot smarter. But I also predict that humans will always be involved in the process of vetting information, especially journalists, because you just always need a human mind in the process, I think. So this is more of a hammer rather than a replacement.
That was Grassroots Institute's Joe Kent talking with HPR's Maddie Bender. The Institute's new AI tool is called Open Hearings. Learn more at our website after the show. We continue on this theme of artificial intelligence. Our next story is about a AI hiccup. We invited Acam Napier, editor of Aloha State Daily, to chat with us after reading a blog he wrote about AI transcriptions gone wrong.
It was just the weirdest thing. One of my reporters, Mike Brestovansky, was reporting on this ranch in Wailua, and there was a hearing before the Honolulu City Council about a permit that the ranch wanted, and a lot of people came to testify about the ranch and the permit and all of that. And so he's watching the YouTube video of the city council meeting, and he has the closed captioning on. And in the closed captioning, my name appears. It's very strange. There's a woman who's testifying. She didn't give a name, so I'm afraid I don't know who she is, but she was talking about the ranch and all the different business names that it uses. What she says is, don't let the Hawaiian names fool you. And what the closed captioning says is, don't let Hawaiian Cam Napier fool you. And I was like, oh my God. I wasn't there. We hadn't even published an article yet. I'm not aware of anyone mentioning me at any point in this meeting. So it was just very strange and also funny. Right?
Yeah, it's
don't let
wacky.
Hawaiian Cam Napier fool you. That's probably good advice. I don't think he exists.
Okay.
So,
and as we try and figure this new technology out, and I don't know how this happened, if it's something with the translation services or AI or what.
Yeah, so I speculated a bit in the column. So those of us in media, we've been using transcription software for many years. And one of the first forms of AI that business has used, it can be an enormous time saver. These are speech-to-text algorithms, and so I assume that YouTube, now owned by Google, is using some sort of large language model or some speech-to-text algorithms to generate the closed captioning. And I speculate that the software just didn't know what she was saying and grabbed my name out of some list of words it had accumulated over time. And why I would appear in such a list, I assume I've been doing this for 30 years, right? My name has been floating around as a byline for a very long time. So that leads me to suspect that YouTube and Google, they've been scraping local media as part of how they train their AI tools. And closed captioning is one of those tools. So yeah, that's how my name is probably on a list of words that the closed captioning might throw in there. When you look at the larger quote from this lady where she says the Hawaiian names of all these different businesses, the closed captioning didn't get any of that right. It doesn't know the Hawaiian names. And at one point, it translates the name of one of these entities into Hyundai, the Korean car company, with a capital H and everything. Now, Hyundai has nothing to do with this ranch either. But if you were relying on the closed captioning of this meeting, you would not know anything that actually happened. It would just be a mess.
Yeah, you said it was AI hallucination?
I did. You know, and there's two things on my mind about both halves of that, AI and hallucination. There's no sentience there to have a hallucination. Like you and I can hallucinate because we have brains in the first place. And we have wiring for thoughts that could go wrong and could generate a hallucination. AI, there is no actual intelligence there. It's a marketing term, really. If we wanted a more accurate term, simulated intelligence would probably be better. It's a clever impersonation of intelligence, and it can do some awesome things, but it's not an actual intelligence. And so our metaphors get all mixed up because it's not hallucinating, but it seems like we cannot find a better word to describe these mistakes.
Yeah, where hiccups. These hiccups.
And I mentioned in my column there have been some lawyers in Hawaii who have gotten in trouble for turning in legal briefs that were researched with AI, and the AI invented cases that never happened. They don't exist. And hallucination is the word we use for these things. But really, these large language models, they're sort of, do you remember Mad Libs?
Yes.
So you have a funny story with words missing, and you have to make up the adjectives and all of that and fill it in, and you get a hilarious story. They're kind of like that. If you ask AI for legal case histories, it'll put together a sequence of words that looks like a legal case history, because that's all its mission really is. And whether or not that case exists, obviously they don't in a number of cases.
And we've done stories on The Conversation. We had the state auditor with the AI-generated podcast so he could get more eyes on his reports getting to people's ears. And I know he shared that they had some hiccups as well, where the AI anchors, if you will, couldn't pronounce Hawaiian words,
and
they didn't know how to fix it. And so, yeah, those kinds of things.
Yeah.
The growing
pains. Yeah, the growing pains, for sure. And when it comes to things like closed captioning, there are alternatives. The good, fast, cheap triangle, right? The way to have perfect closed captioning is to sit and laboriously transcribe it yourself, or use an AI sort of tool to do the speech to text and then scrub it. Just read every word of it, listen to the meeting, and make sure it's all right. In my previous job at Pacific Business News, I used to do video interviews with people, and I wanted the closed captioning to be tidy, you know, as good as we could make it. So it was congruent with the articles in terms of quality. And that meant reading the entire transcript, looking for trouble spots, listening to that portion of the interview over again, making corrections, frequently would get Hawaiian place names wrong, would frequently get people's personal names wrong. Or you could pay a service for transcriptions, where humans somewhere else on the planet will sit and listen to your recording and transcribe it. And in the past, I have, through a service called Rev.com, paid for that kind of transcription. And it was really good. In fact, one came back and it had all the Hawaiian diacritics and everything. And wow. I hadn't even asked for it. And they were all right. But it was quite expensive. So you can either take time or spend money. If you want the fast and automatic closed captioning, you're going to get the kind where things are wrong.
As a former television reporter, we used to have to transcribe our sound bites, and it was very stressful because we were under some pretty tight deadlines. But yeah, at least you knew it was correct. I was in Long's the other day, and I was really surprised because I heard a message over the intercom, and then there was a disclosure. This message was created by a person using AI, and it just startled me.
Right.
And then last week, a friend sent me a TikTok video, a cute baby. And I'm a new grandma, so I'm a sucker for cute baby stuff. And I immediately sent it to my daughters. I go, look at this. And she goes, Mom, that was AI. Look at the fingers.
The fingers are a big tell for now on video. If you see six fingers or more, it's AI. But they're going to figure that out pretty soon. And this is an interesting thing that I got into in my column also, because this idea of the AI company scraping content that is already on the internet to train their models. I'm jumping to a conclusion. That's how my name got into the closed captioning.
Right, you're trying to figure this out.
Right, is that they've scraped local content, news content, and so my name gets into the vocabulary list. But that means that they're scraping local media. And we know that this is going on. It's going on all around the world. And there are actually a lot of lawsuits that have been filed this year by novelists, by major media companies like Condé Nast, Atlantic Monthly, LA Times. They're all part of a class action suit. Adult video producers have sued AI that produces video. Disney has sued an AI that produces video. Getty Images has sued an AI company that produces AI-generated photos. All of these cases are making a copyright infringement claim. Right. These companies, and Aloha State Daily included, Hawaii Public Radio included, right? Every article that's on the website, on both of our sites, the audio too that's archived, the AI bots are out there scraping it and using it to train their AI models. So the argument is, when someone comes along and asks for an image, a recording, an article, whatever, on those subjects, our material that we spent time and money on then gets regurgitated out. And where you see that, and this is something that's really bothering news media quite a bit, is these days you go to Google and you search a subject, and at the top of the results page now is the AI overview, right?
Yes, I've been noticing that.
So the AI, there's nobody at Google, like there's no human writing that. It's the AI overview. And how they got the overview was they took all our stuff and synthesized it. And we don't get the page views anymore. If the average person on the internet who just wants a quick answer to their question is content with the AI overview, they don't come to our site to read the original article. They just take what Google gives them, which Google got from us without even a thank you or a payment of any kind, whatever. So a lot of this sort of thing is going to get hashed out in court cases. We'll see how it goes. There's a lot of cases pending, and not very many have come to a conclusion one way or the other yet.
Yeah, so I guess the bottom line to listeners out there is you've got to be on alert, be a more critical consumer.
You have to be a critical consumer. Don't assume what you're seeing is true. More than ever, you got to go follow the links back to the original source to see if that's what that article actually said, right? Because, you know, that quote, don't let Hawaiian cam neither fool you. Who knows where else that's going to show up now that it's on the internet. It's funny, but it's just so weird. Like, what's real anymore? I don't even know.
Well, you're real in the studio. You're not Hawaiian cam neither. No. But thank you for coming down here and chatting with
us. My pleasure. Thanks very much.
That was A. Cam Napier of the online newsroom, Aloha State Daily. You can find his story at alohastatedaily.com.
Scam ads are flooding Facebook, YouTube, and other social media, from miracle cures for medical problems to get-rich-quick schemes.
If you go ahead and click that link, it'll take you to wardshopp.com. That's shop with two P's. I don't think it's legit.
So why are they everywhere? That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
The U.S. invented technologies like the solar panel and the lithium ion battery, but China got good at scaling them up. And China is so far ahead at this point, it would be extremely difficult for the U.S. to get back into the game.
I'm Rachel Abrams. That's Today on the Daily from the New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30, following Marketplace.
Do you beat around the bush? Well, that can sometimes mean hard topics don't get directly addressed, whether it be in your personal life or in the workplace. But is there a way to be direct with people while still showing you care? Kim Scott wrote two books on it, Radical Candor and Radical Respect. She's to speak at the Hawaii Employers Council annual meeting in Waikiki today. HPR's Jason Ubai spoke with Scott.
All radical candor is about caring personally and challenging directly at the same time. I think so often we feel like we have to choose between being successful and being a kind person. And radical candor is your way out of that dilemma. You can be a good and kind person and be super successful at the same time.
I think that sounds good in theory, but I think it is difficult to give feedback when it is harsh or when it is critical. How do you get to that point where you can deliver that messaging?
Yeah, it's really easy to say, all you have to do is care personally and challenge directly at the same time, and everything will be fine. But of course, that's not how it feels. I think I was talking to a group of business school students, and they said, feedback fills me with existential dread. So what is the way out? If I like to think about things in terms of simple framework. So if you think about radical candor as a 2x2 framework, on the vertical line is care personally, and on the horizontal line is challenge directly. When you can do both at the same time, that's radical candor. But we all make mistakes. There are times when all of us remember to challenge directly, but we forget to show that we care personally. And that is what I call obnoxious aggression. And very often when we realize we've been a jerk, rather than going the right way on care personally, it's our instinct to go the wrong way on challenge directly and to back off our challenge, even though we think we were right. And then you wind up in the worst place of all, manipulative insincerity. This is where passive-aggressive behavior, political behavior, all of the kinds of things that erode trust most quickly creep in. If you think about obnoxious aggression, it's front-stabbing. Manipulative insincerity is even worse, backstabbing. But these are not the mistakes that most of us make. This is just where the drama creeps in. But the vast majority of us make the vast majority of our mistakes in what I call ruinous empathy. And this is what happens when we remember to show that we care personally, but we're so worried about not hurting someone's feelings or not offending them that we fail to tell them something they'd be better off knowing in the long run.
And say you're in that situation right now and maybe not at the point of firing someone, but like they've been on the team for a while.
Yeah, you want to avoid getting to that point. I think that very often one of the problems, especially if we've been working with someone for a while, we have what I call feedback debt. So we have not, something's been bothering us. We haven't said the thing. And so they did it again. And then we didn't say it again. And so they did it again. And it's like a vicious cycle. They keep repeating the same mistake. And every time it gets more and more problematic. And our emotions get more and more tied up. And so I think that the first thing to do when you're in that situation is to solicit feedback. Think about what the other person might say, but don't just imagine it. Go out and ask them. Ask them, you know, what could I do or stop doing that would make it easier to work together? You want to understand what's going on for them. And then you want to remember that it's not all bad. Like there's some things that are great about the person. So make sure that you're taking time to express gratitude and appreciation and give this person some praise when you notice things going well. Now you're in a situation where it's going to be easier for you to tell them what's going wrong from your perspective, to give them some criticism. And when it comes time to have that conversation, you want to start by remembering that you want to be humble. I call it candor and not truth. Because to me, candor kind of implies, here's how I understand the situation. I want to share it with you, but I also want to know how you understand the situation. It's a real conversation. It's not a monologue. It's a dialogue. So you want to be humble when you share this. You also want to state your intention to be helpful. You're not telling the person this thing to sort of express dominance or be a jerk. You want to help them succeed, and you think they can succeed. You also want to make sure that you have these conversations in time for the person to fix the problem. And so if you feel like you've maybe should have said this thing 6 months ago, just say that. Say, look, I've made a mistake. This has been bothering me for a while. I should have said it a long time ago. It's hard for me. Sort of be vulnerable when you're sharing this. You also want to have this conversation in a way that is a real conversation, either in person or on the phone. Don't send an email. Don't send a text. Slack is a feedback train wreck waiting to happen. So make sure you're either on the phone or in person. And if you're in person, I recommend a walk. And I recommend the phone and not a video conference because we often misinterpret facial expressions and body language. You want to make sure the reason why the conversation is so important is that what they say is just as important as what you say. It is a conversation.
It was mentioned in the foreword about that radical candor can be difficult for different people, people of color, people from different communities. So Hawaii is a very diverse place. So How do you become display radical candor when, you know, maybe speaking directly to people is either frowned upon or just not part of the culture?
My second book after Radical Candor is called Radical Respect. And that book is probably should have been the prequel. I should have written that one first. And I got feedback from people that I needed to write Radical Respect because if you don't respect someone, it's very hard to care about them personally, and you're not going to even bother challenging them. And when I'm talking about respect, I'm talking about this sort of regard that we all owe each other for our shared humanity. I'm not talking about having to earn respect for some sort of skill or something, but there's two very different definitions of respect. So I'm talking about this unconditional regard that we owe each other for our shared humanity when I'm talking about respect. And I think that when you think about it in those terms, and then you think about a culture, you know, one of the wonderful things I think about the culture in Hawaii is that it is a very caring culture. It's a culture where relationships mean a lot, where there actually is quite a lot of respect. I mean, I grew up in the South, and that's also a region that is not known for challenge directly, shall we say. So it was something I really struggled with. And the thing that helped me more than anything else to learn how to say what needed to be said in order to help the people around me succeed, which was what I really wanted to do, I bet you every one of your listeners has a time in their career or a time in their life or both where somebody was doing something that was problematic in some way, shape, or form. But you didn't want to hurt the person's feelings or you didn't want to tell the person, so you didn't say anything. And then they did it again and the problem got bigger. But you still didn't want to say anything. Again, all good intentions. You wanted to be nice. You wanted to be kind. You wanted to preserve the relationship. And then they did it again. And eventually, the whole thing blew up in a way that was much worse for that person, much worse for the work that that person was doing, and much worse for your relationship with that person. And if you think about that story, then the next time you're and give it a title. If you think about that story and if you give it a title, the next time you're tempted not to say the thing, the next time you're tempted to walk away from a meeting where somebody just stepped in it, but they kind of maybe have an inkling that they stepped in it, but they don't really know what happened or why it was a problem, you'll realize that if you really care about the person, you're going to go tell them. You're going to talk to them.
That was Kim Scott, who is a keynote speaker at the Hawaii Employers Council annual meeting today. She spoke with HBR's Jason Ubai about her books, Radical Candor and Radical Respect. Well, we have to go now, but up tomorrow, we plan a call-in show around the complex water issues on Maui. The drought has only made things worse, and there's a lot of finger-pointing going on. Got feedback? Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find episodes of The Conversation on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.